Did you want to continue along your train of thought, or I'll just...
I think I finished that.
Now, in June of 63, there were major anti-Shah demonstrations in the cities of Iran, the turnaround among others, that led to military repression, considerable loss of life, as I recall. Was there any discussion about those developments at NSC, among the staff or in the council itself?
I'm sure there was, but I think the I can't remember specific conversations at this point, but I think the frame of mind would have been, well, this is a period of change. There's undoubtedly going to be reaction to it, and indeed it was reaction to the land reform, and so it came back to Shah a number of years later, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, and of course you have, I think, Khomeini having his own mini role, and not so mini later on, but a mini role at that time in that experience. But I think the sense in the White House was, of course, when you break the crockery and start changing things, you're going to have this, so he has to control it, but gradually build the political support that will rally around the course of reforms. I don't remember deep.
Was there any influence in Washington to influence? Was there any effort in Washington to influence the Shah's response to the demonstration? To moderate it otherwise?
I don't remember. Yeah. I'd be surprised if somebody didn't say something, but I don't remember.
There's probably someone in Tehran, I suppose.
Yeah, to Washington. May well have been telegrams going out there, but it was NSC concurrence. Or
okay. Now, in any case, apparently the June 63 events did lead to greater cooperation between religious and secular, religious critics and secular nationalist opponents of the Shah. During the 60s in general, did policymakers and intelligence officials pay much attention to that development?
I do not have a specific recollection of a discussion about that that alliance. Yeah. It was certainly awareness that the land reform program was going to disquiet some of the mullahs, and that you needed some way to cope with that, but I don't remember specific discussions of it. I'm sure there were.
And as you mentioned earlier, the Ayatollah Khomeini, he was a major figure, a fairly major figure in these demonstrations. Did people who were looking at Iran in the 60s know much about him?
I don't think so. I think my answer comes not from that period, but from later on. I think when he emerged as the figure that he became later on, people who the intelligence analysts would have looked back and very readily sorted out his role from that period, and I remember people writing about it, but I don't know that there were many people around other than the experts, the real people who'd served on the scene or done the analysis from back here, that had any recollection that a man like Khomeini had been or knew much about him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, after Lyndon Johnson became president in late 63, did policy continue along the same lines, or was there any kind of a shift in policy towards Iran? Or?
No, there wasn't. The same people continued doing the same thing, I think probably by that time, but I can't remember exactly. Ken Hansen had gone off to other things, but generally I think the thrust was the same. If there was a phenomenon at work, it was not that presidents changed, it was simply that you were by then 3 years into an administration, things had settled down, they were on a course, maybe it would be shaky at times and so on, but a line had been set, and of course Johnson's watchword was let us continue, and indeed I don't remember his in any way putting his hands on this. It didn't seem to need his hand at that point. Yes, when the Shah came, Lyndon Johnson was involved, and directly so, but I don't remember anybody. The other thing, of course, a couple of years later, Comer went off. But I think it was the evolution of the situation more than the change in president that affected the posture of the White House. By the time Johnson began dealing with the Shah, you were dealing with somebody who had some of the elements of success in his hand. It was beginning to make things work and look like it, and was beginning to. During the Johnson period, I think that finally you didn't have negative student demonstrations during a visit of the Shah. And I think during the Johnson period, the Shah came
for visits almost every year. Again, I'm not absolutely sure of that, but I think there were probably 66, 7, and 8, maybe. There were, it was almost a visit a year.
And there were a number of, yes. Pretty early in Johnson's administration, in January 64, I read that the Shah wrote to Johnson complaining that he was not getting enough military aid, and that he would turn elsewhere if his needs were not met in the military aid program. And also read that Johnson wrote back to the effect that the U.S. program was adequate and practical, and he generally downplayed the Shah's expressed concerns about an Arab radical threat. Now, do you recall anything about
the discussion of that letter? A particular letter, but at that time it would have been a letter drafted out of the review procedures that we've talked about, the rather deeply embedded American posture that the purpose here was to keep military expenditures under control for reasons we've discussed. And a Johnson letter at that time would have been produced by that group of advisors, State Defense and Comer and Company, and I think that's what that amounted to. I don't know. And it would have been just an effort to sort of be not be polite to the Shah and be responsive and understanding, but hold the line.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that several months later, I think the Shah made his first visit to the Johnson White House, I think in June 64, and Johnson agreed to enlarge U.S. aid in terms of military credits. He approved around, I think, $200 million in credits to be extended over several years. Which I think was sort of a turnaround in Johnson's approach to some extent in terms of agreeing to enlarge aid after he's saying that it was already adequate. I'm not sure if I'm interpreting that properly, but do you recall anything about
the only thing that I might do differently from what you just said is to not use the word turnaround.
Yeah.
There's a constant tension between keeping the Shah with you, making him feel that we were responsive to his needs, and yet trying to rein his appetite in. I mean, that was something that continued for decades. We handled it differently in the 70s from the 60s, but rather than a turnaround, I would see it as our not being able to hold the line much longer, and feeling that we had to give this much. Maybe it was substantial proportionate. And maybe it looks like a turnaround, but I think people at the time would have seen it more, okay, we've held the line this far, maybe we have to play out a little bit of line right now.
Do you think it would have been the pressure from the Shah, more or less, that accounted for Johnson's decision to enlarge, or to produce
Sure.
Yeah.
But again, the tension was there, and it stayed there, and it wasn't the reaction to it was still to deal with it within the framework that we cared about how much he spent. And after the Nixon administration came in, that's where the change took place, and that was no longer a concern. So I would see this as an understandable tension where we sometimes held the line, sometimes gave some at that point. We gave maybe a good bit, but it was still the framework that we cared about the balance of resource allocation.
But as I mentioned earlier, the Shah had said that he felt surrounded by hostile Arab countries, Arab radicalism. To what extent did senior officials come to agree with the Shah's definition of perceived regional threats?
Yeah. I think they minimized it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you looked in the Shah's neighbors, yes, we were dealing, the Kennedy administration and later Johnson was dealing with Nasser and Nasserism over farther to the west in some considerable detail. At the same time, all the time Kennedy was doing what we've been talking about, or his White House staff, Kennedy was also cultivating a relationship with Nasser to see if he could somehow work out a relationship with Arab radicalism at its source. And by the time Johnson became president, by the time that June 64 visit of the Shah took place, Nasser had told us to go drink from the Red Sea. Johnson wasn't having a good time dealing with Nasser and Nasser's form of Arab radicalism. So it wasn't that we didn't recognize that there was a problem over there. I think we did feel that in practical terms that would account for a specific military equipment response, that the threat was quite distant. And the Shah, yes, could see it on the horizon over there, but if you tried to translate that into a threat projection in military equipment terms, it wasn't there. The Saudis weren't a threat. Iraq was there, but, and so on. That was the mentality. It wasn't to just give the Shah the back of a hand, but just to say, let's be very precise. And this, again, was the spirit of the military review. Let's look at the threats. Let's look at them very precisely. Let's look at the response to the threats. If you're going to hold in the hills here rather than there, you need mountain equipment. It was a very nuts and bolts kind of a military assessment of a practical series of scenarios that represented military threat. And you couldn't translate Arab radicalism into that kind of threat. Therefore, the administration was more inclined to say, all the more reason, Your Imperial Majesty, to concentrate on the soundness of your society and the economy, because that's where radicalism will take hold. Nasser's threat is in the airwaves, literally, Cairo radio, etc., appealing to dissatisfied people in your country. Build a dam, build an irrigation project, get the farmers to work, give them a sense you care. That was the response to radicalism, not the military. And it was that argument, which was so pervasive in the early 60s, all over the world. It was the reason for the Alliance for Progress. You combat communism, you combat Castroism by helping leaders satisfy the needs of their people.
When the Shah made requests like this for, say, long-term grants or credits and so forth, was there much debate in the bureaucracy over whether to go along with those, like maybe people like AID versus the State Department versus the Pentagon? Was there debate?
There was certainly debate. There were differences, but I have a sense of that there was more coherence and unity in the response than there was deep division. I think people by 64, 65 had bought the notion that there were rational ways of assessing threats and gearing our military assistance program. There were important economic things to be done. We established this review process. Let's stay with it. And I, yes, there may have been modest differences of opinion, but it wasn't state for satisfying the Shah versus defense, which was an AID, which were to hold the. It wasn't that battle at all, I don't think.
To what extent, when policymakers made decisions about arms credits, say, to a country like Iran at this period, say, the early 60s, early to mid-60s, to what extent did, say, commercial or balance of payments considerations, they play a role in shaping those decisions, or is that...
I think they were there, but I think the practical role was not paramount.
Okay. Another subject. It's been alleged, this is an article that Walter Goodman, I think, at Georgetown wrote some time ago. He suggested that during the 60s, sometime during that decade, the CIA and the State Department phased out their contacts with various opposition groups in Iran, which they had over the years. These contacts were phased out, more or less in exchange for agreements that would allow the U.S. to maintain or extend stations monitoring Soviet missile tests to the north. Is that ring
CIA true? CIA people, or I'm sure that you're talking to Gary Sick in New York, but there's somebody, he started his book on Iran at Columbia, so
yeah,
I'm sure that he's intimately involved. He or Helms or Helms' predecessor or people like that would be much more precise than I am. I'm not sure I would date this that early. If somebody else would, I'd agree.
I'm just sort of guessing, actually.
I think it was more a phenomenon of the period 69-70 on. I'm not aware of it dating back this far. It certainly was a problem in the 70s, and Gary Sick in his book has described very well the ramifications of the problem that we all
know, like some of the more general ones.
I don't know when the quote, the deal, if there indeed there ever was one, was cut.
How are we doing for time for this?
Probably, if there's a way to move toward wrapping up this portion and then save the 70s and so on for another session, I'm going to run out of time in about 7 or 8 minutes.
Yeah, I can't think of any, because I have some more questions actually from the 60s. Some more, the thing about the U.S.-Soviet-Iran cooperation in the late 60s and some other some major arms sales controversies. Let me stop for a second here.